Item number seven, Lower Snake River Compensation Plan. This is a program overview, so I will turn it over to you, Julie.
Okay.
Department of Interior. No, who should I?
Yes. Yep. Or Chris, did you want to start?
Yes.
Okay, I'm just going by with the first name on the thing here.
Mr. Chairman, just take the opportunity to introduce everybody that's present before us today. And I think this is a little bit different. We've got multiple states and tribes that are all co-managers that are represented. And so give them an opportunity to introduce themselves and tell you who you are, who Great. They are. And we look forward to sort of filling you in on a broad state and tribal effort to manage salmon and steelhead in the Snake River all the way from mouth all the way up into the wilderness areas of Idaho.
Okay.
All right. My name is Joe Dupont. I work for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. I'm stationed just across the river here in Lewiston. And I am the Clearwater Region's fisheries manager. So, to give you a feel for what the Clearwater region is, I guess there's seven regions in the state of Idaho, fish and game regions, and the Clearwater is one of those. And so if you just go half mile up the river where the Snake and the Clearwater join, Clearwater drains all the water all the way up to Montana and much of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness area. And then if you head up the Snake, it manages that all the way to Hell's Canyon Dam. And then if you follow the Salmon River, it's everything north of that. So that would be the area that I'm involved in managing.
Joe Bumgarner, again, you got it. You've heard from me already. And I'm up here just, I'm going to be co-presenting with Becky, who's going to give kind of a presentation as well. But she asked me to talk in about the Fall Chinook portion of it, of her presentation. So.
Good afternoon. I'm Becky Johnson. I work for the Nez Perce Indian Tribe. My office is in Lapway. And I am responsible for the hatchery program that the tribe operates.
Hello, I'm Julie Collins. I'm the program manager for the Lower Snake Compensation Plan program, which is operated out of Boise, Idaho, run by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And we are a staff of six employees, so covering a pretty big area.
And before we get going, two of our co-managers that aren't present, State of Oregon, who's on a statewide travel ban, so we couldn't get our fisheries person that we work with down here, and then the Umatilla tribe that wasn't available today. So with that, I guess we'll lead it off with Julie, and she'll go through what the Lower Snake Compensation Program looks like.
Great. All right, well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about the Lower Snake Comp Plan program. I believe you were given a handout that shows the project area, which covers the part of three states, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. And so the question really is, what is the Lower Snake River Compensation Plan program? It's a federal program administered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to mitigate for fishery impacts caused by the four Lower Snake River dams. It was authorized in 1976 and currently releases about 19 million spring Chinook, summer Chinook, steelhead, fall Chinook annually from approximately 28 fishery facilities in the three-state region. The program is directly funded through Bonneville Power Administration. It's a direct reimbursable agreement with them. And almost all of the hatchery operations, the monitoring, the evaluation, all of the studies are conducted by the states of Idaho, Washington, Oregon, the Nez Perce Tribe, the Umatilla Tribe, the Shoshone-Bannock Tribe, and also the Fish and Wildlife Service. The Lower Snake program has some well-defined mitigation goals that were established back in the early 70s. Those are to return 55,100 adult steelhead, 58,700 adult spring and summer Chinook salmon, and 18,300 fall Chinook salmon to the Snake River. So, move to the next slide. So today I'd just like to talk a little bit about four areas of the program, give you some of the history and the background, talk about implementation back in the 70s and early 80s, and then kind of bring you forward to currently how the program is delivered, and then highlight some of the changes that have come about in fisheries in the Snake Basin and the Columbia Basin since the program began in the 70s. And then last but not least, I'll talk a little bit about performance, and hopefully my colleagues here will be able to tell you more about the fish performance as well. So, this slide shows a stool that has four legs on it and kind of outlines the fish that support the Lower Snake program: spring and summer Chinook, fall Chinook, steelhead, and rainbow trout.
They won't be notified till Monday.
Believe it or not, this whole program began back in the 1940s when Congress approved the construction of four dams on the Lower Snake River. Those were, I'm sure you're well aware of these, but I'll name them: Ice Harbor, Lower Monumental, Little Goose, and Lower Granite. The dams were, the construction funds were appropriated in 1954. And then the dams were constructed from 61 through 75. During this period, the Fish and Wildlife and the National Marine Fisheries Service and several representatives from state agencies started evaluating what the fish and wildlife losses would be due to the construction of the dams, both prior to the construction and then after, you know, how those operations would affect fisheries and wildlife. And so in 1972, a report was produced by that group looking at that, at those losses. And then in 1975, the Corps was tasked by Congress to produce a special report outlining compensation and mitigation associated with fish and wildlife losses for the construction of the dams. And the 72 report was incorporated into that 1975 report. And following that, in 1976, an environmental impact statement was conducted by the Corps. And then shortly thereafter, Congress authorized Lower Snake Program for under the Water Resources Development Act in 1976. So during that 70s period, there was all these reports coming out. And then the Corps at the same time was doing a lot of site planning for hatcheries and facilities to rear steelhead and salmon. So they were doing a lot of that work as well. So it was a pretty productive time. And then in 1983 is really when the program started implementing some of the early fish releases that were associated with the Lower Snake Comp Plan. So, how were the Lower Snake compensation goals established? And it's kind of like a three-part process. First, the number of adult salmon were estimated pre-dam. So everything that was returning to this area in the Snake Basin was estimated. And on the left column, you'll see that the spring and summer Chinook were at 122,000 adult salmon, 114,800 steelhead, and 37,700 fall Chinook. The second piece of the calculation was to look at, okay, once the dams were constructed, what would the loss be from both the construction and then juvenile turbid mortality or adult mortality at the site? And so that was added to the equation. And then the third piece was looking at downstream harvests that would be lost as a result of the dams, and also habitat loss from inundation due to the reservoir filling behind each facility. So given taking all that into account, there's on the bottom of the screen is a spring Chinook total adult computation, and that is taking that, for example, that 122,000 number and multiplying that by a 48% loss and getting 58,700, and then adding those two other components of harvest and habitat loss, and coming up with a total goal of 293,500 fish, which the total goal is not the Lower Snake River Compensation Plan goal. The Lower Snake Comp Plan goal is that 58,000 number. So moving on from the Lower Snake goals, you'll see these, and they're called project area goals in the history on the left side. Again, 18,000, 58, and 55. And then rainbow trout was also added to the goals. And during this period, when the goals were being developed, the state of Washington had a request to... because of lost angler days, I think the computation came out to about 67,000 lost angler days. And if you look at the map, you'll see that all of the dams were constructed in the state of Washington. And so a lot of that river fishing or that tributary fishing was, you know, compromised by, you know, what would become a lot of reservoir area. And so what the Corps did was... they tried to purchase land for fishing access for a lot of this area in the state, but they were met with a lot of local resistance for land purchase, and so that didn't really go very far. And so one of the sort of compensations was to have Washington produce all of the rainbow trout and be able to stock those fish in their area. So that's how that rainbow trout goal came about as well. Okay. And this slide shows implementation. This is an old table from one of the early evaluations for compensation. And what it shows is how the fisheries were allocated between the states of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. And this is from 1973. Back in the early 70s, there was a group of representatives from states of Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and also federal NMFS and Fish and Wildlife Service, and they broke out all the compensation by state, Spring Chinook, Fall Chinook, and Steelhead. And if you look at the totals at the bottom, you'll see that the Fall Chinook doesn't jive with the current 18,000, I think, 700 number, but it's close enough. this is 1976. So, and you'll see that a lot of the program has changed over time as far as where fish are released in some areas and who's involved in the program. And this is just a representation of that implementation stage in 1983. It just shows you what portion is allocated to Oregon and Idaho. 20% of Fall Chinook, and then Washington State had 80% of that production. And then for Spring and Summer Chinook, Washington and Oregon, 15 and 2%, and then Idaho had the lion's share there with 83%. And then for Steelhead, Idaho is at 71%, Washington's at 9%, and Oregon at 20%. And then the next slide just kind of shows how all those calculations were used to produce smolt numbers. And those would be allocated to each of the hatcheries that were being constructed. And then if you look at the Fall Chinook, it's 9.1 million. Spring and Summer are 6.7. And then the Summer Steelhead are 11 million, which is approximately 27 million total smolts to the basin. And then underneath it, there's a row for the 2016, just to give you an idea of the number of smolts that are released currently, which is about 19 total fish. So they had some pretty high hopes for a lot of that production early on. So how did the program evolve? The program, initially, the Corps constructed all the facilities, and they were intended to replace salmon in place and in kind in the areas that they were lost. And a lot of times that didn't occur because of site conditions or unavailable land for the federal government to purchase. Also, water supplies and water resources were either inadequate or low water quality, and so that a lot of times caused them to go to different locations. Currently, the service owns all the facilities and administers the programs, and those were transferred from the Corps in the 80s to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And like I said earlier, the states, the tribes, and the service operate the hatcheries and conduct fisheries monitoring and evaluations and many more things, which I probably would fill the whole screen. But and then again, Bonneville funds the Lower Snake Comp Plan through an MOA agreement. Initially, the service was funded through appropriations, and that funding was fairly flat, and I know early on it didn't allow a lot of maintenance to occur, and now with the Bonneville Power funding, there's more funding to be able to maintain a lot of those facilities. So, and then this is a slide just to give you a glimpse of how many facilities are associated with the program. And again, the states and the tribes really work at all these facilities and run them and operate them and do most of the work here. So I have listed 26 facilities. There's also two other facilities that are not owned by the service but contribute to the Lower Snake program. The value of all of these is greater than $400 million. That's not including the land, and most of the construction occurred from 1980 to 91. And then when you look at our program now, it kind of focuses on three main areas. Basically, all of those fishery operations, trapping, spawning, rearing, and funding all of that, meeting all the local and state and federal requirements, the ESA requirements, evaluation and monitoring success in meeting those goals and providing all the data needed to secure permits and other standards. And then a large part of our program really focuses on maintenance of all those facilities and trying to keep them compliant with a lot of the new regulations. Some of them are out of compliance, and we're currently just finished an assessment of all of those facilities, and then we're going to try to prioritize you know, how we go about repairing those and bringing them up to compliance for passage and screening at those. Some of the other areas, back when the ISRP and the, I'm saying these acronyms and I'm assuming everybody knows them, but Independent Science Review Panel reviews all of our programs, and they've done several reviews over the last 10 years. And so based on recommendations from that, the program shifted to do some integration work with fisheries and rearing of fish and stocks. And so there's several stocks related to spring Chinook, summer Chinook, steelhead, and fall Chinook that are integrated. And also there's juvenile supplementation that is supported as well, supporting that natural populations. Also, outplanting adults is a strategy that is used as well. And then one of the other areas that we focus on is a FINS database program, which takes all the Lower Snake data and puts it into a database, which is used by all the cooperators. That's still, it's not online yet, but that's the goal, to bring that to an online status. Cooperators, a lot of people work on this program. The Corps cooperators are Umatilla Tribes, Nez Perce Tribe, Shoshone Bannock Tribe, Idaho Fish and Game, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, BPA, the Corps of Engineers, Idaho Power, and Pacific States. And you guys will probably, there will probably be more, but it's quite a few. Big program, a lot of coordination, highly integrated. And then this is just really highlighting some of the things that have changed our program since 1976, which doesn't seem that long ago. The small to adult survival rates in some cases for spring Chinook have been less than originally projected. ESA listing of Snake River, Spring and Fall Chinook in the 90s, and then Steelhead in 97 affected where fish were released, how many were released, what stocks were released. The USV Oregon management agreement really impacts where we put fish, what the numbers are. So we're involved in that as well. And then the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, the Independent Science Review Panel, program reviews have had a pretty significant effect on program changes in the Snake Basin. And then just another, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but the reimbursable agreement for program funding has changed, I think, the ability to keep things maintained and in working condition to move the program forward. So I'll talk a little bit about the fisheries performance. I have three graphs with the main adult returns over 25-year period. The first one shows spring and summer Chinook, and the goal is 58,000. We've never met that, even though most of the facilities are at capacity for rearing spring Chinook. And so we're still, I guess, looking at ways in which we can bring those adult returns up. So that's an area we still need to work on. And this slide just shows kind of some of the facilities that rear the spring Chinook and some of the release numbers. This is about a 10-year period. For total number released. And then the smolt to adult survival in the right-hand column kind of shows that variability. And if you're looking at, once the fish are released from the hatchery facilities, how variable it is. And the same with this. This just continues that variation amongst all those facilities. And then we have a steelhead returns, again, about 2002. That one's about 10-year period. We're meeting those goals. We've met those goals consistently and still meet them. And then the fall Chinook goal wasn't met really until the mid-2000s. And, one of the changes that happened over time was early on we had three states in the program and the feds, and then the tribes came into the program shortly thereafter. And so that program expansion occurred probably in the early 80s. That's when it started happening. And so I think having all the cooperators and players on board really brought these numbers up. And I know Becky and Joe are going to talk about some of the success stories related to Fall Chinook. So in summary, the program is highly integrated and cooperative. There's a lot of stakeholders, cooperators, partners, players, a lot of meetings. It's changed over time, and it likely will continue to change. One of the things that might change it is the climate issues, the temperature issues that we saw in 2015. And then we're still working on ways to look, I guess, for meeting goals for spring and summer Chinook. And then we are meeting the goals for steelhead and fall Chinook. And that's That's it for me. Thanks. Do we trade places?
I think I can go from here, if you're okay with that. Good afternoon again. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak with you. I have worked for the Nez Perce tribe for the last 23 years or so, and as a technical staff, have never had the opportunity to meet with the Washington Commission. So, whereas we meet with Idaho Fish and Game Commission a couple of times a year. So this is, I appreciate the time, and I look forward to sharing some of the information I have with you. I thought I'd start by giving you some background about me. I don't brag around about this to my Idaho counterparts, but I'm actually a Washington girl. I grew up in Leavenworth, Washington. I was lived on East Leavenworth Road, and the Wenatchee River ran through my backyard. And I remember when I was a kid that my dad would go down to the river and catch a couple salmon before he went to work in the morning. That was kind of my first introduction to wildlife. I went through hunter's education when I was 13 and got my Washington hunting license at that time. And hunted up Icicle Canyon and Grindstone Creek and shot a buck. So, and I could tell you all kinds of stories about growing up in Leavenworth. It's a special place to me in my heart. Went to Eastern Washington University, where I thought I was going to be a physical therapist, and then I was introduced to fish biology by Dr. Al Scholes, and decided I was going to become a fisheries biologist. So I've since then I've worked for the Nez Perce tribe. And I share this with you because I'd like you to have, I think probably as resource managers, you also have connections with the land and the resources. You have a special place in your heart for that. And I think then you could appreciate a tribe, the Nez Perce tribe, who have lived here in this area, the Nimiipuu country, for since time immemorial. Forever, this has been their country, and they have been responsible for the resources, protecting and working with it. So, in fact, I work with a gentleman named Joseph Oatman, and he is a seventh-generation descendant of Chief Looking Glass, who signed the 1855 treaty. So, again, the connection to the land and the resources are huge for the tribe that I work for. So I'll give you that as some background. This is obviously a map of the Snake River or in the states of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, and this would be a state's perspective. But if you overlaid Nez Perce country on top of us, this would be a biologist working for the Nez Perce tribe's perspective. So this map, I don't have a pointer. I wonder if this will work. Will it? Oh, Joe. Good co-management. So this map right here, this outer boundary right here is what's called the Indian Claims Commission boundary, and that's what's been determined to be within that boundary is the exclusive use area of the Nez Perce tribe. That was the area used exclusively by the tribe. When they signed the treaty in 1855 in Walla Walla, they established this as the reservation. The 1855 reservation. So what you can see is that obviously that contains Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. Gold was discovered a couple years after they signed that treaty, and so the current reservation, which was signed in 1863, or established then, is a much smaller area. I want you to understand that because the tribe is not just a co-manager in this basin on the reservation, but in this entire exclusive use area, usual and the custom area. And so that's why when I start talking about the hatchery production and the different programs that we do, we have a say or co-manage in all of the hatchery facilities in the basin. So Julie talked about, my apologies. I forgot about the Shoban tribe and the Umatilla tribe. They are also co-managers. So Julie talked about lure snake comp production, and I wanted to, that's part of the production that occurs in the Snake Basin, but it's not all of the production. There are other facilities and other programs that contribute hatchery fish. So I kind of wanted to give you a step back and give you a little bit bigger picture. This is a graphic of salmonids, juvenile salmonids that are released above Bonneville Dam, in the Columbia Basin above Bonneville Dam, okay? Some of these programs are in the USV Oregon Agreement, and some of them are not. But I wanted to give you some perspective. There's a couple of things that are important. One is that, so Snake River, Spring and Summer Chinook, these two together, that's the bulk of the production that occurs above Bonneville Dam comes from the Snake River. So this is the spring chinook that come from above McNary. That's the upper Columbia. and this is from Bonneville to McNary. So that gave you an idea of the production, and it's not just their snake comp production, but there's some other production. And so this map will give you some idea about that. The pink facilities are lower snake comp facilities, and that's what Julie just talked about. And that's about 10 million of the spring summer Chinook that come out of the basin. Idaho Power also produces a good number of fish, 4 million. Their facilities are in this darker purple. And then Bonneville actually funds, not through the lure snake comp program, some production, and the Fish and Wildlife Service does as well. So altogether, between those three states, there's about 15 million spring and summer Chinook that come out of here annually. One thing I'd like you to know about this is that every single one of these hatcheries right here, except for Kuski, is built specifically to mitigate for a hydropower dam. So as long as the dams are there, this mitigation has got to occur. One of the things that's interesting in the snakes, so there is a lot of co-management. It takes a lot of us working together to figure things out. This will kind of demonstrate that. So 15 million juveniles is a lot of fish, right? And in addition to the hatcheries, you got to have what to make those fish, adult fish that are returning. So the co-managers in the snake annually work very hard to make sure that we're producing those 15 million juveniles, and the brood stock required to do that is about 10,000 adults. So what this graphic is, or this slide, is by release group, by every hatchery in the snake basin listed out. We have a preseason forecast that we think is coming back to the basin, which is listed right here. So this year, this is 2017, by the way. This year, we were hoping at the beginning of the year that there would be almost 62,000 fish coming back, adults. We track on a weekly basis with using pit tags how many are actually coming back. So by release facility or release site, we have an idea of how many are coming back. And right now, over Bonneville Dam, we have about 18,000 of those fish. You guys already know, I'm sure, that this is a tough year, right? So the other thing that we do is by facility, by release location, we have the broodstock need all figured out. And so we meet and talk about how are we doing with this, how are we going to make it. We need 10,000 fish to do these programs. And based on that, then we may have some harvest. Typically, we would have harvest. This year, there are places that we're closing fisheries, like in Northeast Oregon. So I don't know that that's a well-known fact or whatever, how this happens, because I guess maybe people assume the fish go out and they come back and you harvest them. But this is a lot of work that we do to make sure that we're going to provide those juveniles. So enough of spring Chinook. I wanted to talk about fall Chinook, and this is where I'm going to get some help from Joe. You guys saw from the core presentation that we collect broodstock at Lower Granite Dam. It's highly coordinated. Nez Perce and WDFW are the main producers of Snake River Fall Chinook. And if you don't know the Snake River Fall Chinook story, you should learn it, because it's a huge success story, and you guys are part of it. Washington is a big piece of this. So I stole these slides from Joe. He gave it at a presentation a couple of weeks ago, and instead of trying to give the presentation myself, I asked if he would do it with me.
Okay, thanks, Becky. Give me my pointer.
Oh, sorry.
Gotta have my pointer. So we gave a really good presentation here a few weeks ago. It was kind of a Fall Chinook Symposium, and it got all the current information together, because we've got some potentially big changes coming up here pretty soon as far as hatchery production goes. And of course, just working with all the managers and co-managers, which are extensive. And we do get together twice a year basically all agencies and researchers and everybody that are interested in Fall Chinook. Basically twice a year, we all get together for half a day. We talk about problems, issues, what happened last year, what's going to happen this coming year, and it's a highly coordinated program. So Becky mentioned that, Julie mentioned that as well, but you can't get beyond it, really. There's a lot of players, and it gets rather confusing sometimes. But this is kind of a map of current fall Chinook distribution. Is up here where you see some of these different colors. historically, Fall Chinook used to come all the way up to here and through all these different tributaries. And because of a lot of dam construction and other, you know, actions that occurred from over the past century and stuff, it's estimated that about 80% of the 80% of the available area has pretty much been lost because of all the different actions. And so we're left with, you know, this little tiny piece down here. Now, because this, you know, happened way back when, the runs and returns of Fall Chinook over the years rapidly declined. And it's estimated back in the, like, pre-1940s, it was pretty much believed that probably 500,000 Snake River Fall Chinook used to come back. And by the mid-70s to early 80s, those numbers were down in, like, less than 1,000. And so there's been just, you know, a lot of stuff that have occurred. The runs have really been declined. And it was a good thing back when that the program, the Lower Snake Comp program, stepped in, because it was down to pretty drastic measures. And, in fact, Washington was to the point of, before Lyons Ferry was completed, which was the first hatchery facility that was meant to produce Fall Chinook for the Snake River, they started an egg bank program that took fish from the Snake River. They actually took them down to Kalama River in the lower Columbia, reared fish there, and returned adults back to there, and then brought the juveniles back up into the Snake just as a stopgap measure before the hatchery was completed. So it was really some some foresight by the managers back at that time just to keep the stock alive. And then since that time, of course, it's been slow because we were at such low numbers to get the program built up. But with the addition of additional programs, and Julie, why don't you go to the next slide, maybe, I think?
Sorry.
That's okay. With the addition of some additional programs that have come online since that point, and that would be kind of down here where we've got the Nez Perce Tribal Hatchery came on through this act right here, and then Idaho Power, another act that Idaho Power also produces fish. So we've got basically three main programs right now that release Fall Chinook in the Snake River Basin. Other things that happen just besides the hatchery production is there's been changes to the hydro and the habitat. There's been different actions, as you guys heard earlier from the Corps of Engineer folks, about improving passage of the dams. And that's been really important for Fall Chinook, especially because the main life history pattern is a sub-yearling. And a lot of the sub-yearling survival way back in the 70s and 80s through the hydro system was not all that good because they migrate out at a different time of year. They need to kind of have summer spill, all sorts of stuff, which wasn't occurring quite a few years ago, and now it is. And based on the information we have, the survival of sub-yearling Fall Chinook now has greatly improved, which has definitely helped improve the runs in more recent years and stuff, besides all the, you know, additional hatchery production from these other programs. Go ahead, Becky. So, again, similar slide, or same slide that Becky had before, and you can see here, these are the Fall Chinook released above Bonneville Dam. And while we may not be the main player, as like Becky alluded to for the spring sec summer Chinook, we're still contribute quite a few fish that come out of the Snake River Basin for Fall Chinook. And so, just to give an idea of this lovely graphic, I love this thing. Just to show the complexity of the current program, this kind of shows, if I had it all together in nice format, I could piece it all out. But basically, here's Lower Granite. We trap fish here. They go to Nez Perce Tribal Hatchery or Lyons Ferry Hatchery. The juveniles get spawned. We start incubating, rearing fish there. Some of the fish from Lyons Ferry then go down to Irrigan Hatchery to get reared as well, because we need more space. And then we have releases that go all the greens and some of the pinks, either a direct stream release or acclimated release to different facilities spread throughout the basin, and that's kind of how the program works. And it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on up there, and it takes a lot of coordination, and it's a lot of different agencies, and we're crossing state boundaries and all sorts of stuff. And so it takes a lot to make it all happen, which is why we get together twice a year to talk about it. Otherwise, it wouldn't go very smoothly, but it goes very smoothly as it is. Okay, go ahead. So, again, this has been a really good success story. Like I said, we were way back in the late 70s, early 80s, almost down to nothing. Drastic measures were taken. Lions Ferry came online right about right here, and you can see that really not much happened for a few years, and that was in a lot of ways because we were limited on brood stock that we could actually get, and a lot of the releases that we did do didn't perform all that well. And again, that gets back to some of the sub-yearlings and the hydro system or the hydropower system operations. And then in the late 90s, this is when we started seeing some additional facilities start coming online from the Nez Perce Tribe. And then mid-2000s, Idaho Power, Nez Perce Tribal Hatchery came online, and the number of fish have just kind of increased since that time. And so, you know, we've seen just greatly dramatic increase. Now, you look at the numbers up here, I mean, we're still at, you know, maybe 50,000 total fish. Remember before, they said, you know, pre-1940s, they thought it was 500,000 fish coming back to the snake. So, while we've made great progress, we're still a long ways behind from the way things were before. Now, granted, with 80% loss in the habitat that used to be used, the chances of ever getting back up to that unless something can be done is probably going to be unattainable. But it is what it is. That's what we have to work with at this time. Go ahead, Becky. Oh, okay. And there we go. And then that just adds kind of what the current 10-year averages have been for hatchery origin abundance and natural origin abundance. And you can see here from this is the minimum viability for natural origin fish is established by the NOAA technical team is 3,000 fish. And so in more recent years, or at least the last 10 years, we've been above that, which has been really good. And in fact, that's prompted a lot of people. There's been a couple petitions already with NOAA Fisheries to talk about delisting the stock. Now, whether or not that's going to happen anytime soon, there's a bunch of criteria that have to take place before delisting can occur. But just that people are talking about it from where we were 30 years ago is pretty darn impressive. There aren't many places in the Northwest that are talking about delisting salmonid stocks, but this is one of them.
Actually, I'd interject. I don't know that there is another one in the Columbia, in the Pacific Northwest. So this is, again, why you should know the story. It's very cool.
There is a couple. Mid-sea steelhead and hood-cap chum.
Oh,
I know, you don't care. and again, just to illustrate some of the successes, these are just fall chinook red counts in the Snake Basin that have been done over time, and of course they just definitely mirror what the returns have been, and just to demonstrate that not only have we got successful spawning out on the spawning grounds, but we've widely distributed these to pretty much most of the available spawning areas now, whereas way back in the late 80s, early 90s, a lot of these places were completely unoccupied. So, you know, at least we've kind of done our best to spread them out as much as we can to the places. And it's, you know, seems to be doing a pretty good job. So I think that's it. Oh, no, I got more.
This is the best part.
I know, this isn't my presentation. So harvest. Harvest has definitely been a pretty strong component of this program over the years. It's always been important for salmonid fisheries in the Columbia River Basin. So whether or not it's out in the ocean, down at the mouth of the Columbia, in some of the tributaries, and whether it's tribal or sport harvest or non-tribal commercial harvest, Snake River Fall Chinook have always played a pretty big role in that. So this next slide here just kind of illustrates, at least for the most recent time period, the line in the blue here, these are returns to Lower Granite. So you can see we're in tens of thousands here. So we're in the last few years, we've been up in the 50, 60,000 range. And then if you look at the harvest, has been in the orange bars. And so that's all harvest, Columbia River, ocean fisheries combined. And the line here just kind of represents the total contribution of that. And so typically, we're probably somewhere in the 40 to 50% exploitation rate on this stock, which is relatively high, I think. I'm not
amazing.
Real familiar with all other stocks, but Becky says it's amazing, so I'll believe her. And then you can see from the pie chart over here, those fish are widely distributed in fisheries. The bulk of them definitely come out of the Columbia River. This is this point here. But we've got fish all the way up from Alaska clear down to California of this stock that are being harvested, because we get both life history types, yearling, sub-yearling, they tend to go in different directions sometimes off the coast of Washington and stuff. So, again, very important. And our hatchery production, of course, that comes from this has helped reboost some fisheries that were definitely lacking back in the late 70s, early 80s. And I'm sure they've appreciated some of our efforts to get more fall chinook back. So I think that's it.
That
right?
Is,
now
that
that's
is.
It.
Okay. Yeah.
Increase in natural origin starting maybe in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. Is that related to hatchery reform practices and brood stocking?
Well, so actually what it is putting hatchery fish on the spawning grounds. So prior to 1998, actually, the fish were released below Little Goose Dam, which so Lower Granite and then Little Goose, and then the hatchery fish were released below the dam. Mm-hmm. So they weren't put into the natural habitat where they could spawn and successfully reproduce. So actually what we've done is we've used the hatchery as a tool to put fish back in the habitat.
Yep.
So, I mean, amazing might be an overstatement. I don't think so, but when you look at this graph and you say tens of thousands, you know, 30, 40,000 fish being harvested, that's a pretty amazing thing. Plus, we've had such a response to natural production that people are talking about delisting. That's pretty cool. I also wanted to talk to you about our COHO programs. It's kind of a unique thing. This is also not sponsored by, I'm sorry.
No.
Did you have a question? Okay. I also wanted to tell you about our COHO program. This is something that's different. It's not funded by Lower Snake Comp. You can see that on this graphic, when you look at production above Bonneville Dam, the Snake River just has a small little piece. This is something that the tribe started also in the 1990s and did it with pasting together some funding source, mostly Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds, to do this. So COHO, this is a graphic of a COHO returning over Lower Granite Dam, and what you can see is COHO were extirpated from the Lower Snake, from the Snake River in the 1980s. And so they weren't part of the Lower Snake Comp program. There was no hatchery production for these fish. So we started a program with some eggs from downriver hatcheries that were surplus, and we've seen a really pretty amazing response. 2014 was an awesome year, was a good ocean year, and we had a lot of returns. 2015 and 2016, I don't have on this graphic, was much lower. 2015 was a horrible year for COHO, and you heard from the folks at the Corps that we actually went down to Lower Granite Dam, and they helped us get broodstock for our program. So the returns in the last 2 years haven't been as great, but the returns in 2014 were sufficient for the state of Idaho to implement a COHO fishery, which is the first time they had done that. So it was pretty cool story. This is just a graphic of where we actually got the COHO eggs, down in the lower river below Bonneville Dam, and then where we rear COHO at Dorshack Hatchery. I wish I had, this is another story. The COHO return to the Clearwater has been a great story for the tribe, because the COHO were spawning in streams and coming back to places where there weren't fish for a lot of years. And I had a video that shows fish spawning and all stacked in there of these coho up in Clear Creek. It's a very cool story, but it's been a real important story for at least the tribe, and I think also for the state of Idaho. So based on that success, we were able to work with the state of Oregon, and this spring, just a couple months ago, we reintroduced coho to the Grand Ronde Basin in the Lost Jean River. We released 500,000 coho, and we're starting a coho reintroduction program there, and so pretty proud of all that. It's a hard work. My last slides, I'm going to talk about steelhead a little bit too, because the Snake River is a rock star for steelhead production. I don't know if you knew that or not, but most of the steelhead that comes out of the Columbia River are produced in the Snake, over about 10 million or so. And so this map shows you kind of where those fish come from, basically. Idaho produces most of those, just like the spring Chinook. I also don't know if you know that bee steelhead are from Idaho. That's the only place that bee steelhead are produced in a hatchery. And the major population areas where those steelhead are spawning naturally are circled there. And so, again, there's Lower Snake Comp production. The facilities are in pink. Idaho Power also produces steelhead, and the Corps of Engineers produces steelhead at Dorshack to mitigate for blocking off the North Fork Clearwater. So kind of, in summary, highlights of production and different programs that we have going on in the Snake that we're happy to share with you. And then, unless you have questions, I'd turn it over to Joe DuPont.
Just one quick question. What were the estimates of steelhead returns prior, say in the 1940s, where we have information about or estimates on falsing? Any idea what our steelhead run returns were?
They were part of your presentation, weren't they?
Yeah.
114,000 or something,
something
like that?
Like that, 114,000.
114,000.
That was in the mid-70s.
Oh, yeah.
historical 1940s, I don't think we have that number for you, Commissioner.
Yeah.
But it's likely greater than the 114 because Hell's Canyon Dam blocked off a tremendous amount of waste steel.
Gotcha. How much habitat do you think we can potentially recover out of the 80-some percent that we've lost? I mean, we can improve habitat in these small tributaries, but we're not going to acquire, as you said.
You're not.
Habitat that's needed to get back to the levels that are.
So Fall Chinook are different from Spring Chinook and us and Steelhead, where they are using the main stem rivers to spawn the bigger water. And so when Hell's Canyon blocked all that, it's like 1,600 miles of habitat or something above it. When they blocked off that main stem river, we lost that habitat until those dams are gone. And then when the Lower Snake Camp, when the four Lower Snake dams were put in, they also inundated habitat in that section of the river. So the habitat we have is pretty much the habitat we've got to work with.
Okay.
Yeah.
You want to trade me?
Sure.
All right, before I begin, I just want to thank all of you for allowing me to speak to you today. It's not too often that somebody from Fish and Game gets to speak to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission, and I really appreciate it. So, also, I want to give a little bit of background about myself as well. I was actually raised in a town on a farm around Moscow, so I'm kind of a local boy. But then I moved all around. I lived in Alaska, I lived in South Carolina, Maine, came back, started working back in Idaho. And then, purely by chance, I got a job working at Aleutian as the fisheries manager, and it's kind of exciting to be able to come back and manage the same waters that I used to fish as a kid. So it's kind of a full circle there, a very exciting thing for me. So I'm going to kind of change the talk a little bit. I think Julie and Becky really covered the different programs where we're releasing fish in upstream of the Snake, I guess. And so I'm going to kind of focus more on Idaho and the importance of these anadromous fish to Idaho. And so let me just start out, contrary to what some people think in Portland, that even though we're 350 miles upstream from the ocean, anadromous fisheries are really important to us. Historically, people used to fish for thousands of miles for anadromous fish in the state of Idaho due to the constructions of dams, and then more recently, because Idaho Fish and Game wanted to protect wild fish. The amount of miles of stream that you can fish in Idaho certainly has declined. We fish about 800 miles of river, so it's certainly not a small amount, but it's certainly short from the thousands of miles we once did. Because of these fisheries, though, they're hugely important in the state of Idaho, not only to our anglers, but from an economic standpoint and just from a way of life as well. In the state of Idaho, I think you saw what we have fisheries on Summer Run Steelhead, both the A and B run. We have fisheries on Spring Chinook, Summer Chinook, Fall Chinook, and recently we even had a fishery on a coho. So we have quite a bit of diversity in Idaho, as you can see by the picture there. We have areas where you can fish close to town, where the boats line up. We also have very remote areas where you can get in there and fish by yourself if you so desire. So quite a bit of diversity and very important to people in Idaho. So in Idaho, all our fisheries right now are structured around where we release hatchery fish. And so Julie and Becky kind of covered where these fisheries or these fish are released. I just want to state that in the state of Idaho, we release 25 million smolts of all those species I just mentioned. And so they provide not only fishing opportunity for people in Idaho, but as well as people in Oregon and people in Washington and as well as the ocean. So a lot of effort goes into these hatchery programs that benefit all the downstream fishing opportunities. And because of all these releases in Idaho, we have fisheries that go year-round. And so that wasn't always the case after some of the low salmon numbers we had. But now with all some of the improvements we're seeing, we do have these year-round fisheries. Probably right now, steelhead are the most popular in Idaho for a couple reasons. They're consistent. and so people can count on them. And they are 10 months out of the 12 months we have salmon, our steelhead fisheries. And some of these fisheries are world-renowned. We get people coming from other countries. They call me up all the time, ask me when the best time to fish is. So steelhead is a big deal here, and again, it's because the runs have been consistent. People can count on it. They can plan on it. Now, the salmon fisheries, I think, are getting more along that line. We provide salmon fishing 6 to 7 months out of the year, and I would fully expect if the salmon abundance increases in Idaho, you would see that be much more popular. Just people love catching and eating salmon. So you can see when we do have the fisheries and there's ample numbers, the type of crowding we get to pursue those fish is pretty incredible. So this is a pretty complex table, but it's just my attempt to show you how important some of these anadromous fisheries are to Idaho. I don't want you to look at all of it. We're going to focus on just this yellow box. And so this is a table I summarized from a couple economic surveys that Idaho did on and anglers, and it shows how many trips they fish in different waters and how much money they spend in their efforts. And this is just summarizes in the Clearwater region. Remember, there's seven other regions or 600 regions in Idaho. And you can see that based on these two surveys that Idaho anglers, when they're fishing for anadromous fisheries, they take hundreds of thousands of trips and spend, just in this one region, $60 to $70 million annually. So I think it's safe to say that in the state of Idaho, all the areas we have anadromous fisheries, anglers will spend more than $100 million annually in their efforts to fish it. So it's not small potatoes up here, very, very big deal to us. Obviously, how much people fish and how much they spend depends on the size of the run, and that's what this graph is getting here. I just summarized some easy data for me to get to. This is shows the amount of effort or how many people are out there fishing compared to how big the run is. In this case, I use the y-axis as hours, our harvest share. And this is for spring chinook in the Clearwater Basin. And as you can see, the larger the run is, the more people that come to fish it. And so it doesn't really matter. I could look at steelhead numbers up in the Salmon River or anywhere. You see the same pattern. You get bigger runs, you get more people. In fact, when we had 2001 giant runs, people came out of the woodwork that probably hadn't salmon fished before. So I think the message is here, consistent and larger runs are very important to us. It gets the effort out there. It really boosts the economy. The concerns are that if you have down fisheries for a consistent amount of time, you start losing interest in these things, and people will learn different hobbies or different things to do. A good example is in the Upper Salmon River, where we had salmon fisheries shut down for many years when they first started opening them not more than 10 years ago. People didn't really remember where to fish or how to fish, and it took a while for people to start getting interested in it. And now that we've had those fisheries open for 7 or 8 consecutive years, you're starting to see that interest build up. So again, an emphasis, and I think it's the same for all of us. The more fish we have coming back, the more people that we get interested in, the more people we can keep focused into this type of fishery. So that was my quick and dirty of the Idaho fisheries, but I also wanted to talk about a couple positive scenarios where Washington and Idaho are working together to manage fisheries and the Nez Perce Tribe. And the first one I want to talk about is the Fall Chinook program. And as you just heard from Becky and Joe, this program is hugely successful. We went from just a handful of fish entering Idaho to now where there's so many fish, some say they're exceeding their carrying capacity. And so there is a ton of opportunity out there to be had. And right now our fisheries only target the clipped fish. And right now about a quarter of the fish that come into Idaho are clipped, so we're greatly restricted in what we can harvest. So I would say we being Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and the Nez Perce Tribe all believe that there's a lot more opportunity, and there certainly is out there to be had. So we're actually working together on a fisheries management plan that would allow us to harvest these unclipped, natural, and supplemented fish. And I think what you'll see when we do this, you'll see the effort just go through the roof. I think we opened this fishery the first time Idaho did in 2008, I think it is, and it was just a something somebody would do when they're steelhead fishing, they might catch a Chinook. And then people started realizing, hey, I can catch some of these, and they started focusing, and effort started going up and up. And then all of a sudden it started dipping down. And I think one of the reasons the effort started waning is because people were frustrated that they couldn't catch a fish that they could harvest. They kept catching all these unclipped fish. And so I'm fairly confident that if we get this plan through, which I think we can, you'll see harvests increase dramatically in effort, not only in Idaho, but as well as in Snake. So that is what I had to say about fall Chinook. Chris, did you want to add anything into that? Or
nope? I'll wrap it up.
All right. And the other positive interaction that we've been having with Washington recently is management of our steelhead. So as you all are aware and you've heard, the B run of steelhead is predicted to be really poor this year. And even before Idaho Fish and Game had a chance to discuss internally, hey, how are we going to manage these fish if the forecast is true? Chris Donnelly calls me up and says, hey, Joe, we're really concerned about this run. We want to make sure that not only we protect the wild fish, but we also make sure we meet broodstock, because we understand that the hatcheries in Idaho are releasing these fish for everybody downstream. And I can tell you that that is the first time I've ever had anybody call me up, and I greatly appreciate it. And I think by working together, I think we've got a situation where we'll make sure that we'll meet full brood, even with very poor runs, and as well provide protection of those wild fish. So I think Washington, Idaho tribes, all of us can work together well, and we have in these particular cases. So that's what I have for you today.
Whose is that?
Hey, I have
what's your slide?
Oh, that's Chris's. Yeah, sorry.
Just a quick question about in Washington, we've had some difficulties in getting permits from the feds, HEMP permits for our hatcheries. Has Idaho had better success, or are you do you have some hatcheries that don't have federal coverage?
We're working on it.
I think Becky better cover that one. She's more involved.
I might be able to answer that. We are working very hard on that. So NOAA Fisheries has been, in fact, developed what we call the HGMP Task Force as an effort to really get on the hatchery consultations. And so we are scheduled by the end of this year and working with them through that task force. We meet monthly and do updates on where we were and make sure that nothing gets stuck anywhere. We are on schedule to have all of the hatchery programs that are in the USV-Oregon agreement through ESA consultation by the end of this year. That wouldn't include hatchery programs that you would have that are not contained in the USV-Oregon agreement, so programs in the Puget Sound or something like that. But all of the programs above Bonneville Dam that Washington operates would be done.
And a comparative question also, has Oregon or Idaho been in contact in any way with Wild Fish Conservancy?
Or have they been in contact with you?
Or have they been in contact with you? Yeah.
I don't know. So.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I had that conversation with Lance Hebden, who is on the USV Oregon table for our panel for Idaho. As of yet, I don't believe they have had a serious conversation with the Wild Fish Conservancy somewhat like we do pretty regularly. And we're hoping that permit coverage here and some of our programs, hatchery reform that's occurred across the basin from a steelhead perspective, will cut that off at the pass.
Okay.
I can tell you from impacts of hatchery fish and wild fish in Idaho, we have what we consider wild steelhead areas, large wild steelhead areas. So we have the entire Lock Cell Selway area. We have the entire Middle Fork area that we release absolutely no hatchery fish. And so I guess from our perspective, we do provide a lot of just natural areas, and hopefully that will reduce some of these issues coming up. So.
And I'll just add, I think the Mitchell Act lawsuit really kicked NOAA into gear on setting up that task force and really kind of pulling everybody together and really making that a huge priority for the basin.
So did that letter from the
Yeah, right.
So I'll wrap this up, just a few brief comments, some things that Washington, I wanted to support where we are from a mitigation perspective and values outside of Falls Chinook, and some of the cooperative work that we do with co-managers here. You know, our very important fisheries are steelhead, and Becky said it, the Snake River is a steelhead factory. Some of the lower tributaries that we drive fisheries are in the Toucan and Touche. Grand Ron, there's actually a direct fishery at Lions Ferry Hatchery from a direct release there. Just didn't want those to get skipped over where the mitigation value for Washington residents is. But then the other part of this is from a hatchery genetic reform, stuff that the commission's been through for a very long time. Where are we protecting wild steelhead specifically, and what are we doing to address that over time? We've got endemic steelhead programs that are integrated in the Toucan and Touche. In the Walla Walla River, we're likely to suspend all hatchery steelhead releases in the mainstem Walla Walla itself. And Assotin Creek is an intensively monitored watershed. And Ethan Crawford was here earlier, and if he has anything to add, I guess he could. But that is a wild steelhead gene bank and a very successful wild steelhead program in the state of Washington. And then lastly, just want to talk a little bit about Spring Chinook. We got a lot of big successes in Spring Chinook in the Upper Basin, and then we have the Toucannon River. And the Toucannon River is stuck in between all these hydropower facilities, and it is limping along at best. And commitments to you as co-managers that we sit at this table is to figure out how to solve the Toucannon River. This is the most frustrating system for Joe, who's been here for a long time, trying to see success in this. And I think it came up a little bit earlier today about Toucannon River steelhead. We're seeing things like 70% pre-spawn mortality in Spring Chinook in the Toucannon River. In fact, we're at such a desperate place. Every adult Spring Chinook that shows up into the Toucannon River system is currently being held in Lions Ferry Hatchery and then re-released into the system in August to spawn. So this thing is really on life support. So part of the charge, and when I say future plans here, is working with Becky and the Umatilla tribe to try to figure out how to create replicate populations, recover habitat in the Toucannon River to assure that we see full mitigation of Spring Chinook in the Toucannon Basin, and then add to that and put Julie on the spot a little bit. Falls Chinook look really good from a mitigation perspective. We're getting close to hitting those goals. We're probably there with steelhead. We can tweak our programs a little bit to ensure that recreation is done better. We got a long ways to go with Spring Chinook. We have a long ways to go with Spring Chinook in the Toucannon, and we have a long ways to go with Spring Chinook in the Upper Basin. So as much as I think there's a really positive story, we also know there's a lot of work in front of us. I guess I'd wrap it up with that and thank the four individuals that were here today, and thank you for allowing us to give you a pretty good synopsis of where we think we are in the Snake Basin.
Thank you, Vian.
It was very informative.
Terrific.
I learned a lot.
So. Absolutely.
Yeah. And thanks for teamwork. That's co-management, teamwork, yes.